This is the Aftermarket Radio Network.
Carm Capriotto, the pioneer of automotive aftermarket podcast. Hey, welcome. In this episode, my panel will be dissecting a pertinent issue when it comes to selling any business. Now, that is wanting more than it's worth. Many of you have worked for years, and you want to get $1 million for your business. Now, as a business owner, you've been painting a very specific picture in your mind about retirement, where you're going to live, what you'll be doing, and most importantly, what will your nest egg look like? Now, too often, your ideal price tag does not line up with the bottom line financials of your business and its true market value and what the buyer's willing to pay. And if you're a buyer, how do you bridge that gap from want to real value? My panel rolls up their sleeves and discusses both sides of buying and selling a business. So much great stuff, great info right here in this episode if you're struggling with this issue. Hey, thanks to our partners Shopware and Broadly for sponsoring this episode. You know, when was the last time you heard a customer say, "Thanks for taking my money"? Get Shopware shop management software, and your customers will be shouting it from the rooftops in overwhelming five-star reviews. Learn more at GetShopware.com. Hey, are you tired of wasting money on ads that no one sees? Well, Broadly can change that. Broadly gets you more Google reviews so prospects will see your shop when they search for auto repair in your area. Exactly what you want on the web at getbroadly.com/chat. You recommend the podcast to a friend. We always have real conversations on topics that we know are very important to you. I got a heck of a panel. I think you just saw their picture. But let me bring them in one by one. Hunt Demarest, CPA, Parmelis, accounting firm focused on automotive service shops. Good to have you here, Hunt.
Thanks for having me, Carm.
You're always welcome here on this show. Joe Hansen's here from Gordy's Garage, Roseville, Michigan. He is going to become a multi-shop owner probably within 30 days, right, Joe?
That's right.
And the reason Joe is here, because he's a fresh one. I mean, he actually bought something, so we're going to get a great perspective from there. And multi-shop owner Brian Bates from Eagle Automotive, Columbine Hills, Colorado, the Napa National Auto Care Shop of the Year 2018. Hey, Brian.
Thanks for having me out, Carm.
Glad you're here. How many shops?
We got five right now. Should be closing on our sixth one here in the end of September. So here in just a few weeks. I think Joe and I are on the same page there.
And that's exactly why you're here. Been there, done that, Brian Bates. And he's obviously bought a few shops and maybe have had to deal with valuations, which I think is one of the big topics we're going to talk about. And I've heard this way too often. So you're going to sell your business? Yeah. What do you think you can get for it? You know, well, it's not what I think I can get, as I got to get $1 million. And that was the hard work of all the years that I've put in. Oh, by the way, I told the wife for the last 5 or 6 years that I can get $1 million for the business. And that was the big annuity that's going to land in this bag that we're going to take and buy the lake house with. As I pause only to let that all sink in. In my opinion, it's all about valuations. And Hunt and Brian and Joe, I know that you guys are going to speak to this. And I think that's the learning curve of this episode. What's my business really worth? I don't want to sit across from a buyer. I want to know before that happens. If that information comes to me and it's not quite what I expect it to be, once I figure out who I'm selling it to, I have time to work on it. So, Hunt, I mean, isn't that what you share with your people all the time?
Exactly right. I mean, sometimes people look at it and they say, well, Hunt, why would I value my shop right now? I'm not going to sell it this year, so I don't really care what it's worth now. But like you said, everyone has this magic number in their back of their head of what their shop is worth. Brian can attest to this, Joe can attest to this. Anyone that you try and go buy a shop from, the number that they want is usually much, much above what the market's actually willing to pay, right? Brian might have lucked out on a couple of shops and got a deal on it. But usually, you know, that's an unfortunate conversation that you have to have with an uneducated buyer of, hey, I know that you want that, but it's not really worth that much when you really do the numbers on it. But like you said, the biggest thing that we're looking at here is, okay, let's say that you want to get that $1 million for it. You do the valuation as of today, even knowing that we're 5 years out from that. Not only do you know what your shop is worth today, you know what is really affecting that valuation. You now have a game plan on, all right, this is what I need to switch. This is what I need to change. Or maybe it is in line, and now you know that you need to show some consistent numbers to give that track record that, you know, prospective buyers are looking for.
Which begs the story, guys, that I probably need some help to get there.
Just in my search for shops and just getting started with this, is we sat down with a shop owner and his wife at their house, and they invited us over for dinner, and it was a great or not dinner, but just a dessert, actually. It was a great conversation but then we got to the price, and I said, so what are we looking at? And they said, we'll make an offer. And I said, well, I'm kind of looking to where you're at, you know, where I don't want to, you know, let's start somewhere. You got to have an idea of what it's worth. And I said, so, you know, they said, well, we're not selling the building. I said, that's fine. I said, okay, so for the business, okay. And I said, so what are you thinking? And they just would not tell me a number. So I said, okay, well, what are you making? And we went through that quick process of, you know, at the end, it ended up being a net of about $140,000-$150,000 a year. And I said, okay, well, based on a realistic starting point, probably about, you know, 450, maybe 400, right around there. I think that's a good starting point. And they came back and said, well, that's crazy. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. I said, well, that's why I kind of wanted to get a value from you. What are you thinking? And they said, well, we were thinking 1.2 million. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. I thought we weren't selling the building with it. I just was talking the business. And they said, no, that's just the business. And I thought, oh, wow. It was a little bit awkward because I'm sitting in their home at their table with their nice dessert that they made for us. And I'm a $500,000 off. So it's like, wow, and I said, can you tell me how you got there? Cause I'd love to help you, help me convince the bank that we could give you that for it. Cause they're going to be the ones wanting to see this. And he had said, well, I put 30 years in. I mean, this is a long time. I put a lot of my whole life into it. And I thought, man, I appreciate that. And you build a fantastic business. So it's just, at this point, this is what the value is. The mathematical formula is this. And so it was a little bit awkward, right? So to your point, it's important that we really do know how to value our business so we don't put ourselves in that position to think, because if we think we're going to get this big number and then we're 60, 65, 70 years old and we go to sell and we're $500,000 shy, retirement looks different.
I think you're exactly right, Joe. And the fact of the matter is that most of this on the seller's side is highly emotional. Yeah. And so trying to remove as much emotion out of the conversation as possible and get them to a logical state of mind, that's a big challenge. And when you look at the buyer's side, it's very objective, right? I mean, fairly non-emotional, and you're looking at it going, you know, with a lot of questions in your mind, depending on how much you know of the business and the inner workings and the people inside, there is always a sense of apprehension there because you just don't know what the future will hold. If you could look into a future, you know, a crystal ball and say, hey, look, over the next 10 years, we're going to make an average of $200,000 a year on this acquisition, then all of a sudden everything becomes very clear and concise, and then you can put a serious hard number on it. But there's so much uncertainty on the buyer's side. So reconciling both sides is a challenge, and that's really the opportunity of the buyer and the seller, really, is to get everybody as close to possible, because there is going to be a gap almost always. Get everybody as close as possible to each other on the price. And I think any way that you can do that as far as an objective third party, that seems to work out best, unless for some reason, you know, somebody says, hey, look, you know, my business is making $500,000 a year and I'd love to sell it for $100,000. Then all of a sudden we don't need anybody involved in that unless, there's some skeleton in the closet somewhere. When we bought our fourth business, he wanted somewhere in the 900 to a million, and we were right around the 600,000 with it. And we just kind of said, well, how do we get there? And so I approached his accountant and said, hey, can you recast his numbers and add all the discretionary spending back into the financials so that we can really see how much of this is earned income and how much of it is business expenses that we're going to inherit when we buy the business? And he said, well, I think the best solution here is I have a friend that does business valuations, and he's fairly inexpensive, and I've seen $10,000-$15,000 valuations, and I've seen his that run in the, you know, the low thousands, and they almost always come out exactly the same. He's pretty sharp, and he's not going to dig into a bunch of stuff, but it always really boils down to the financials and the balance sheet and the history of the business and whatnot, and the seller's discretionary earnings. So we did that, and the accountant said, hey, you know, really what we're looking for is we're probably going to, you know, end up at a number that is higher than you want to pay and lower than what he wants to sell. And I said, okay. So he was a great third party and a trusted source for the seller, and so this he also talked to the seller and explained the process, and the seller did want to sell. He was motivated, and so he came back and he said, okay, let's do that and see where it ends up. Didn't commit to anything. When we did get the valuation back, it ended up being $800,000. He said, well, it could sell for $750,000, it might sell for $950,000, but most likely you're looking at about $800,000, and that's where we ended up. And then it's all, you know, then you start negotiating, you know, terms and, you know, a few other things, how much the owner's going to carry, how much you're going to put as far as your asset purchase allocation for the selling price, because that's going to affect your taxes over the next 15 years. So, So that's it's at least a starting point, and that seemed to work really well for us. We did it on the fifth business that we bought, and the seller was hardly making any money. I think he made $20,000 in 2020, and so we really had to put our thinking hats on and figure out how we were going to get to a place that he wanted, which was, you know, right in the you know, the $500,000 area. And so after, you know, a lot of, you know, going back and forth and digging into the business, we were able to come up with a plan to get him where he wanted to be. And one of my favorite sayings when I'm talking to these sellers is, hey, look, I'm not looking to steal your retirement, but, you know, I don't want you to steal mine either. So let's find a, you know, a way that we can come to a common ground and get this deal done and try to help them through it, because more than likely, this is the first time that they've really done anything like this. And you know, they honestly, they wouldn't have another reason to. You know, we're not in the, even as a multi-shop owner, I'm not in the habit of selling businesses. I'm in the habit of buying them. And so having somebody to help you walk through that process and gaining their trust and making sure that they know that you're there working with them, not against them, is extremely critical.
Great, great advice. I've just got millions of comments on that, Brian. I may reserve them till later. But Hunt, we had someone ask, what's the best tool to evaluate or estimate what a shop is worth? Does the CPA play a very strong role in this, or do you have to go out to the business evaluator?
Well, Michael is lucky enough that he has someone that can do both of it. So I do valuations here. Usually we don't even do valuations for a shop. So we do what's called a calculation of value, because like Joe and Brian alluded to, shops are bought and sold of really one metric, and one metric alone is a multiple of the seller's discretionary earnings. Sometimes people call it a multiple of net income. Essentially, what you're trying to figure out is you're trying to strip out all of these non-recurring expenses, you know, one-time charges, personal expenses, above or below market payroll, above or below market rent. And you're trying to just strip this down and say, what would this business really make if it was just at its foundation? And whatever that number is, over an average of 3 to 5 years, you would multiply that times 2.5 to 3 times. That is kind of the usual range that we see shops selling in, is 2.5 to 3 times that. If you are getting bought out by one of the big boys, private equity is starting to come into this market, we see the multiples go a little bit higher. If you're kind of in a distressed situation, you really need to get out, we see the multiples on the lower side of things. Right now, the market's pretty good, so it's pretty holding pretty close to that 3 times multiple.
So interesting. Brian and Joe, please comment, jump in at any time. How bad did you want store number 5 that you were willing to work the numbers?
Well, some days pretty bad and some days not at all. So we, you know, what it really boiled down to is that we really did have to evaluate what we were looking at and what the cost of starting a new operation would be, in the sense of, you know, deferred earnings. You know, the shop was already up and running. It already had somewhere around $1.2 million in revenues, and getting a location in that area of town. So we did look at a lot of marketing data, and I've done this before with a brown project is what they're called, right? A building, empty building. So you have greenfield and brown field, and then ongoing businesses. And I know how much it costs to take a building that's been empty for quite some time and turn it into a profitable enterprise. And so a lot of that came into play when we decided, okay, how much are we going to pay him for this? Also, he had four technicians working for him, and we know how difficult it is not only to hire technicians, but hire the right technicians that are good, that work well together and that have a good chemistry. So, so in the end, I really viewed it as a startup rather than, you know, compared it to a startup rather than comparing it to others on the market. And there, you know, in Denver, there's not a whole lot on the market right now. And so that made it fairly easy to look at it and say, okay, can we turn this into a profitable business? And sure enough, really boiled down to leadership. There just wasn't any, you know, real quality leadership going on in the business. And so we feel like we're pretty strong in that area. And sure enough, once we got involved in it and really put some leadership in place and started working with people and encouraging them, setting goals, putting career paths in place, igniting the fuel within all the team members, it just lit up immediately. I mean, the first month was a transition month, so it kind of stayed steady. And then the third month, and now the fourth month, they've exceeded last year's revenue by about 50%. So, so that's been real telling. The other thing is, Hunt, you can probably attest to this a little bit, is that we were surprised because we were in this 3x EBITDA and we were really expecting to pull out the owner's salary. And what we were seeing was a lot of the valuations that are going on right now, really, they don't work on EBITDA for a single shop owner. They're working on seller's discretionary earnings, which is abbreviated SDE. So basically, you take everything that the owner is paying himself, all the discretionary earnings, if he's got a truck in the business, a vacation home, anything that is personal, and you put it back in there, and then they multiply that times three, at least right now in the Denver area. So learning that, hey, there's several ways to value this business, and you've really got to have a handle on what that owner is thinking about and what he's being advised of, because that's going to really play into how the negotiations go.
You know, adding back the owner's payroll. And so in some situations we add it back, in other situations that we don't. And so this is a huge thing, if you're listening here, that goes into the value of your own business is, we see this all the time. Hey, you know what? Brian is making a pretty decent profit. You know, he's got a small shop. He makes about $75,000 a year in bottom line. Now, Brian is also the service advisor as well as the owner. And so if you look at a situation like that, Brian doesn't actually have $75,000 in profit, because I need to structure this of what this business is going to look like. I'm buying a business, not a job. So once I recast that earnings and say, well, I take the owner's 75 out, I put in a service advisor for 75,000, now this business is not making any money. And so some of it is, if you have an owner completely hands-off, working from home, you know, they're always going to be somewhat involved, right, to some level. But, you know, really just as an advisory role or something like that, then, yeah, we're adding almost all of it back. But if you're integral in the day-to-day operations, you're the shop foreman, you're the service advisor, you're the general manager, then we can't really realistically justify adding back all that payroll, because if we get rid of that payroll, that business is no longer operates. You know, it's missing an integral piece of its business.
You're right, and that's absolutely objective. And I think the wild card here is that if they're talking to any sort of, you know, business broker or any sort of business valuator, theme of this podcast is, I want $1 million for my business. And so there are a lot of people out there that are telling owners what they want to hear. And so a business broker there's a good chance that the business broker is going to put this on the market and let reality sink in. And you may be the first person that's talking to this owner and he's going, nope, I've been told it's worth $1 million, whatever. And they are adding in all their discretionary earnings. They're very important to the business, all that sort of stuff. So then it becomes becomes a really, again, a fine line of how much can we grow this business? What are we going to be paying for? What parts of the business and what's the potential? And if there's very little potential, you know, they've capped out as far as their space, then it becomes to me very unappealing. If it's a 3-man operation in a 15-bay facility that's got reasonable rent and whatnot, then it becomes something that looks pretty promising. We're saying, okay, we'll ante up and maybe overpay a little bit to make you happy. But then we're going to have the opportunity to, or something of that nature.
Let me ask Joe a question, and Hunt, please chime in, because the question is really all about getting an Excel spreadsheet in your hands, building a pro forma, which would be what's this business going to look like this year? What's my debt service going to be? What's it going to look like in year 2 and 3 as you anticipate growth? And is there going to be enough cash to pay my debt? Did you do that, Joe?
Hunt knows I did that. we took a couple stabs at her with that. We basically just did what we call a financial forecast of what's to come, right? And it takes a lot of time to do that. It really does. It's a lot of analysis, a lot of detail. But I think it's very important to do it because, I mean, if you don't, number one, if you're going through the bank or especially the SBA, they're gonna pick it apart. But I mean, it kind of bigger picture, right? I mean, we look at the business plan and how we're going to execute this transaction and what the business is going to look like afterwards. And quite frankly, I don't know that the bank really looks at the plan, but they do in fact look at the numbers. They pick those apart, and we prepared. And Hunt helped me with this. We prepared properly for that, and having a proper financial forecast, a pro forma, however you want to call it. It really, the bank said, wow, this is very prepared. This is great. We're good with it. And it was a matter of, 2 hours they were submitting it. So to your point, Carm, yes, we did do it. We were very thorough. We had a very strategic plan all the way down to even the marketing funds, what it's going to look like when we take over, what type of marketing we're going to do. And that wasn't just like, we're just going to do what they did. We're just going to, use some direct mail on that. It was down to car count. How many customers are we losing with attrition, all the way to how many new customers do we need times the average ticket, times the response rate of that media that we're sending out. This is what we're going to need to spend. And so I did that with each line item. And what was also very important to do is for every expense, we wrote an assumption of why that expense would be what it is. And we justified every line item. And that might have been over the top, maybe. It took a lot of time to do it. But I will tell you that even the bank, when they got that and received it and they read it, they were like, wow, okay, we completely understand. Because these are bankers, right? They don't understand our business all the time, from what I'm told. And so we prepared the roadmap for them to understand it so that when they looked at it, they're like, yeah, okay, go ahead. Let's move forward. So
no, and that's exactly right. And that's what like Joe and I were laughing about before, because a lot of people look at this and they're like, oh, the bank wants projections. And I'll be honest. I mean, projections aren't usually worth the paper they're written on. They're worth, whatever you're willing to put into it. Sometimes banks go out and they say, well, hey, you're going to get this loan. We need projections. It's like, guys, it's going to be the same business. We just got more money here. But like Joe was talking about, when we're doing the projections, if you're buying another location, you're trying to expand your existing one, whatever it might be, the projections are obviously something that the bank is going to require. It's something that you need to be doing as the buyer, though, right? Because that's where you're going to highlight this and you're going to say, does this make sense? You know, like when we went back to, if you're adding back the entire owner's salary, that's going to wash out. When I do my projections, I say, all right, I'm going to have to hire a service advisor. Hang on a second. Based on my projections, I'm paying $400,000 for this business that's going to lose money through year 2 if I don't do something drastically different, And like you said before, like we're going to have debt service on this unless you're sitting on a ton of cash. Let's make sure that this makes sense based on the changes we have to do and, hiring and firing and stuff like that. So hugely important, and just not something to be looked at as just the banker's trying to give me this requirement. We needs to do it.
Because at the end of the day, like when I'm looking at this, when you're buying another location, especially because it's my second purchase, but my first expansion, if you will, it's not about getting approved for that loan or getting that business. It's not like, cause that's like a battle, right? That's like a, you're going through this and it's almost like a game and you just want to win, you want to get it done. But at the end of the day, it's like getting it done isn't the end solution. It's acquiring this business and succeeding in it so that the team that's currently there, we're serving them properly by knowing what the heck we're doing as owners so that they can have a great career working for us as the new owner. That's the real end game, right? That's the real legacy of the transaction, if you will. So that being said, it is so important to have that plan laid out so that you can execute it and know what your debt service ratio is going to be and make sure you can afford it. And it's not just an emotional hype deal. And at the end, it's like, oh, why did we do this for $10,000 more a year? I got all these headaches. We want to succeed by having a proper plan. So I just think it's essential.
Hey, Carm here. And coming up, find out why joining a networking group helps you as a buyer or seller. When it comes to vehicle service, you're crushing it. But when it comes to day-to-day operations and customer service, can you say the same? Do you have a seamless workflow that blows customers away? If not, you may want to consider Shopware, the industry's leading shop management system. Most of us can remember the days when auto shops thrived off carbon copy forms and phone calls. Well, the truth is, times have changed. Manual processes and physical paperwork can really cost your shop time and money. Our friends at Shopware have developed a software platform that can simplify your operations and leave your customers saying, wow. If you're like the rest of shop owners that are constantly monitoring their Google reviews, you'll want all the help you can get driving those enthusiastic reviews from happy customers. Head to GetShopware.com today to book a demo and see how their team can get you there. Did you know there's actually a best time to ask a customer for an online review? It's true. According to Broadly, asking for a review right after service is key. Think about it. That's when the car looks good and the customer is happy and in the best frame of mind to give you a good review. And all those good reviews, well, that's what's going to get the attention of people who search for auto shops online and get you even more customers coming into your shop. Do you have a company helping you out with reviews? Do they make sure each customer is being asked to leave you a review? Broadly gives you the confidence to ask and receive more quality online reviews from your clients. Get Broadly's system. Help prospects have confidence in your shop when they see a large number of 5-star reviews. Make the move. Visit Broadly on the web at getbroadly.com/chat to start chatting with a Broadly representative and learn more on the web at getbroadly.com/chat. Know your buyer. I mean, this whole show is really about helping people think about, you know, selling their business because we are in a prime opportunity with 6,000 repair shops closing in 2020. COVID's a factor in there and everything. But I want $1 million for my business. Okay, the reality starts setting in. But part of the numbers that are critical and important, part of the synergies that are really important, I'm sitting across from Brian Bates, and I know how badly he wants this place, and I know he doesn't like to start from scratch. Doesn't that help me knowing the profile of my buyer?
The more that you do on both sides as far as reviewing what the motivations are for people wanting to enter into the transaction, the better chance that you have success. And you know, it's just like selling car work. Price is important, but the representation of that price is really where you get the value out of. And if you're priced higher than somebody else, some of your competitors, you've got to justify that value. The motivations are a bunch of different factors, and you, or as a buyer, you want the seller to know some of those motivations, but you obviously don't want to tip your hand too much and let them know that, you know, I'm dying to buy this shop. You know, my wife, whenever we're going into a large purchasing decision, I'll have her visit with me or whatnot, and then I send her home when we start negotiating because I know she's the one that says, you know, hey, oh man, the neighbors are going to love. She's already talking about, you know, how it's going to fit in the house just perfectly, or, you know, how much we're going to enjoy it. And the seller's going, yeah, we got this guy. he's he's got nowhere to move versus, you know, me saying, well, yeah, you know, I don't know, I could take it or leave it sort of strategy. So so I think that's there. And the one thing I'd like to talk about, what Joe was hinting on, is that we are in the people business, right? I mean, to look at this as purely a transaction and all about money and business and whatnot, really doesn't give the value and really the impact that it deserves, because as business owners, there's a lot of people really depending on us to get this right. And if we go in there and mess things up and just go in emotional, we don't have the resources, we don't understand the business, we don't have the time to give it the attention and to deal with the transition and training and integrating and all the things that go into it, there's a lot of people that have been at these businesses for a very long time that could be negatively impacted, and that's not fair to them. So, you know, the fourth business that I bought, there was two employees there. One had worked there for 40 years and one had worked there for 30 years. And if you can imagine their anxiety to having a new owner come in and start, you know, talking about that he's going to come in and transition the company and the old owner is retiring and whatnot, that was extremely stressful for them. So I took it very personal that we went into the business and we took special care to reassure them, and it wasn't just one conversation, it was multiple conversations over several weeks before you could start seeing them just kind of calm down and actually earn, you know, get your trust, and you were earning it and whatnot. You know, lastly, I will say that one of the biggest motivations and one of the key advantages that we have compared to some of the bigger companies and even some of the smaller companies is really finding out what the motivation of that seller is. And a lot of times it is not purely based on price. Their legacy is very important to them. How their customers are treated moving forward is very important to them. And especially their team members' well-being is very important to them. So when we start talking, we start comparing and contrasting. If you sold it to this kind of buyer, you might get a little bit more money, but are they really going to take care of your, you know, your customers that you've known for, you know, maybe three and four generations? You know, what about the team members that have aspirations that have really trusted you? And are you going to be looked at as somebody who took a big check and abandoned everybody? Or are you going to be looked at is you retired and left them in a great place and really cared for them as you moved on. And that seems to really help the conversation moving forward and get the sellers invested in what you're doing. And it can't be manipulative, right? It's got to come from your heart. You truly have to be doing this because you want to take their legacy and honor that and start transitioning that into what you're building as a legacy and help them continue their identity as where they were, especially if they've been at the business for a very long time, and start moving into their identity as the new company and have that as part of the canvas that they've experienced or that they're putting together for their career, and be happy with it versus just saying, hey, look, we bought this business, there's a new sheriff in town, things are going to change, you know, get on board or get out sort of mentality. And if you do stay it but you don't do it, they'll pick up on it very quickly. If you're not true to your word or you're not sincere about it, then they're looking for, even we've had situations in these last two transitions where even though we were doing everything out of sincerity and sincerity and trust and in everyone's best interest, we were questioned several times about our motivations, and there's just a lot of things that are going on in people's heads where they say, you know what, this is what I thought was going to happen, and the reason you're doing this is this, this, and this, and so you have to be able to come back and say, no, let's settle down, let's refocus, get everybody, you know, centered again, and run back at it one more time.
Thanks, Brian. Joe, or Hunt, I have a question for you. I'm a shop owner, and I've had this attitude my whole life that I just don't want to pay taxes. And so here comes Joe Hansen riding on his great horse, hooking it up to my little stable, and he says, let me see your financials. And Joe says, you have nothing to sell me. We have a very difficult business going here.
that whole point of normalizing the P&L or looking at the seller's discretionary earnings is so critical here. Do we overcome that? Do we start making the business more profitable, move things in a different place, pay the owner more so that the discretionary earnings aren't there? Give us your opinion of all of that.
You know, everyone here is closely held business, right? So everyone has one goal in mind, and it's pay the least amount of tax legally possible, stay in, you know, above board everything, right? And so everyone that is going to be an educated buyer coming in looking at your shop is going to realize that there's stuff going on there, right? Realize that there's stuff that is not essential to the day-to-day operations, but you can't get too much into the gray area, right? It has to be black and white. Like, look, X, Y, and Z were in there. Add that back. You and I both know it doesn't really need to be there. I'm choosing to do so. Now, what happens, though, is there's a lot of trust involved in this, right? And, you know, some people do more due diligence than other, but you really got to get to know the person that you deal with and say, hey, can I trust this person? Because you could put whatever you want on the financial statements, and that's what we're going off of. You know, the biggest thing that I tell people is if you start having some, you know, just way too much stuff going on here, you're just going to lose all credibility. I mean, the number one question that comes up when I do calculations is, well, Hunt, you know, you and I both know that, you know, $50,000 to $60,000 of cash doesn't really go anywhere. That kind of just disappears. You know, we need to be able to factor that into it because that's really what is going into my business. That really would have shown profit. And then the conversation I go back to the prospective seller is, so we're going to go to a prospective buyer, explain to them that we're willing to lie to the IRS, that we're willing to lie to the state, but they're to believe what we're telling them. You know, and it's just such a ridiculous thing, but it happens a lot. And so, you know, if you really want to go, I have some people that go and say, you know what, for the next 3 years, nothing is going through my business. It's all going to be above board, 100% legitimate. Obviously, that's the most ideal situation because you look at the tax return, you look at the financials, there's no add backs, nothing needs to be done. Now, if you're someone that lives in more of the gray area, the creative side of things, I'm going to do their work for them, right? So I'm going to say, hey, here's my tax return. Here's what the true earnings are. Here's how I got there so that we can go down line by line and I can justify that if you ask me. But if you just go and you throw it out there and say, hey, my tax returns show a $30,000 loss for the last 4 years and I want $800,000 with no other backstory behind that, most people might even just say, you know what, we're just so far apart. Good luck. And I'm going to move on, you know. And so you really got to do your homework if you're going to do that kind of stuff.
I love his point, guys, because the seller doesn't want to tell you what he's been burying. Who knows, you may be wearing a wire, right?
And I think spoken that's from somebody from New York, right?
Your point is so well taken. I mean, because I think you said something like 3 years to really work on legitimizing, and it's not a good word, or normalizing the profit and loss statement so that when you show it to a prospective buyer, you're not having to, you know, row backwards.
You know, you just want something that is just so clear, you know, someone that has the clarity. And like I said, the big thing here is trust. You know, this is all about trust. And I think Brian and Joe could attest to this. Even if, let's say, the numbers looked in line, the price that they're asking is fine. If you just kept on getting kind of these weird things like, hey, a couple things I found just didn't add up. And, you know, the guy's talking about doing really sketchy stuff in his personal life. To me, if I'm a buyer, I'm saying, you know what, time out here. If I really want this thing, I'm probably going to spend some money and really, you know, dive into this forensically. Or you might just say, you know what, I got a bad feeling here. You know, like going to buy a used car, like, hey, it's running fine, but you know what, there's just some really weird signs on here and I'm just going to walk away from it. So you got to make sure that you're transparent, got to make sure that you're being on the up and up and, you know, something that works for everyone.
Hey, Joe, I want you to chime in, but I also want you to think about this. The seller has to be very aware that no matter what they anticipated or promised their significant other, that it's still the hard facts. And I guess there's been so many deals done when once the emotion, you know, if you will, the air comes out of the balloon, maybe 2-3 weeks, 2-3 months down the road, then, and you do find some pushback, then there's an opportunity to have, I think, as Hunt or maybe Brian said, an objective discussion.
Correct. Yeah. I think that you know, I just from my little experience so far, I've seen, you know, cause I've went through the process a few times to get to a success now with a few of them. And those other ones had some emotion involved in them and they couldn't get over that. So it didn't work. Right. But I think we need to, I'd like to take a bigger picture approach to this though, because the majority of the shops that are on the market, if you will, at least in this area, are baby boomers that are, they're at the point where they're saying, you know, it's time to get out. And I think that if we look at this the right way as a win-win, right, we can be that vehicle that helps them exit the industry successfully. And to Hunt's point, doing business and purchasing maybe a shop from somebody that you can trust, that's a huge, huge deal, because, you know, these are major investments, and this is not an easy business. It's a lot of variables in automotive repair. I mean, with technicians and advisors and, you know, just all the stuff. We all know this. So for me, one of the things that I like to, you know, when I'm talking to the sellers, you know, how do they value their employees? Because at the end of the day, we got a building which you can get anywhere. You got, you know, customers, we can generate new customers, but it's all about that team at the end of the day. And so if that owner treats their team bad and they're abused, if you will, I mean, that's going to devalue to a degree, a little bit, of what that business is worth. Or if that owner is the type of guy that's like, I don't care what you do when you buy it, you can fire everybody. I could give a rip. I'm not so sure I want that either, because then I don't really trust that owner. But if you find that owner that, you know, during your initial sit down, say, you know, hey, what's motivating you to want to sell? What's going on here? And they say, well, I want to sell because I want to go to Florida. Okay, good. They got a plan B. And then they come back with, but I got to find the right buyer, because these guys are the reason that I'm actually able to retire. This team that I have has given me a life that, you know, I would have never had without them. So that's a different buyer, right? I trust this person now. So, you know, you can add value to that, you know, because you know you're going to have, number one, a stable team, but you're walking into a team that, you know, if they're healthy, they've been treated fairly, they've been treated right, and the owner loves and cares about them, there's a good chance I'll be able to carry that on. And for me, that's very important.
Well, and I'll add to that, for me, when an owner has been either, you know, neglectful or abusive to his or her team members, generally that drives away unicorns, and the only people that stay are those that that will put up with that, because they might not have better options, or that's, you know, the environment that they're function or that they're comfortable with. So that, to me, that's really the biggest reason why it devalues it. You also, I mean, my first shop I bought from a guy that's kind of a scoundrel, and I was able to overcome that. But you know, true to form, the people that were working there just were very low level individuals, and we ended up having to, you know, switch everybody out. But it, you know, wasn't for lack of trying. It was just, hey, this person just doesn't align with the values that we have as a company. So that's very important. And you know, I'll add a little bit on the emotion there. Sometimes the more logical somebody is, that can be frustrating as well, because it's very black and white, and they don't see the value in the soft qualitative parts of the transaction, and that could be the legacy that they're leaving behind, or you know, what the value is that that you're bringing to their employees, or how strong you are as a buyer if they're not selling real estate and they're just they're holding on to the real estate, now you're a tenant. So and I'm, you know, I'm very comfortable talking about emotional aspects of a transaction, and so when it gets too logical and I can't really get somebody to find a common ground with me on those qualitative parts, that can almost be debilitating for me, because I'm going, man, you don't get it. It's like trying to talk to a customer that doesn't understand the importance of having master technicians versus some guys at a quick lube place, you know, doing a timing belt. You know, hey, it's just a timing belt. What does it matter, right? You're going, no, you don't understand. This is, you know, important to have this experience and this quality repair and the warranty that comes after the sale. So they're all fascinating. And I got to tell you that it's extremely fun and energetic to to do the growth thing, not only to grow the business, because it's just fun to kind of see where I can go as a business owner, but really watch team members when they've been put in a situation where it's a very well-defined management, service advisors, you know, ownership, and there's not a whole lot of upward mobility, but then to come into a multiple shop operation and go, wow, there's a lot of room to move up, and people are moving up on a regular basis. And now I want to give 100% so that I can see where I can go as a company. We had a conversation with one of the shop foremen this week at one of our new acquisitions. And he was fairly reluctant or apprehensive, I think, when we first bought him and bought the location. And he told us last week that, hey, look, you know, I love how much opportunity there is in this company, and I can just see, you know, my ability to grow personally is limitless at this point. So I really want to see where I can go in the company and what options are available so I can put a career plan and a growth path in place for me. And so to me, that's really rewarding as an owner to say, hey, look, we're going to, you know, take people and give them the opportunity to reach their fullest potential.
Thank you so much. Listen, I want to do a last call here and kind of sum it up, but I've got so many pent up things going on, spinning up here. And let me just say this. If you do a last call for me, think about these things. You have to look at location. You have to look at team. You have to look at customer. And you have to look at reputation. A lot of those are things you can't touch. There are, if you will, soft values there. But it would be awfully tough to go in and try to overcome all of that stuff. Like, as you were saying, say, do a brownfield from scratch. There is some value there. And then, Hunt, I want to talk to you about this. If the owner was the centerpiece of the business, and the minute they left, it could implode. Is there a deduction that I would make on that valuation as a buyer?
For sure. Yeah. And I've seen people even walk away from those situations because they say, you know what, in order to pay something that he's either going to entertain, it's just never going to be a logical return on investment, right? Because you're buying a lot of pieces here: reputation, customer base, employees, location. If you lose an owner operator that is still the face of the company, you've probably lost three of those, right? Reputation is gone because, you know, Gordy's didn't have a reputation. Joe did, right? You know, you lose your customer base because they didn't come in to see my shop. They came in to talk to me, you know, and then a lot of times the employees, you know, hey, I'm there because of that person. You know, the employee one you can get over if you can really, you know, put a good show on and really step up and take care of these people. But if you have someone that's too integral in the business, you know, that's a really tricky thing. And you're either going to have to substantially come down on the price to overcome that and justify that, or, you know, maybe it's just something that's just not going to work out.
Thank you for that. Last call for you, Joe.
For me, just going through this process the first time, I've learned a lot, I'll tell you that.
By the way, congratulations on becoming a multi-shop owner soon.
Thank you. And, you know, for like Brian knows this because I'm in a group with Brian. It's like, for me, and this is going to sound different than what our conversation is today, is you have to, if you're going to enter into this game, this arena, this next level of shop ownership, you really have to have the support around you. Number one is at home. You got to have that support at home. And second to that, you need to have a support of people that are like Brian, like Hunt, that are in this game and helping people be in this game to be around you, because you literally, it's not like you look at Brian and you think, oh, he's got five shops, that's cool. But the amount of stuff Brian went through to get to five shops and the ups and downs and the stuff that I'm beginning to see going through, and it's like five steps forward, 1,900 steps back every day. Then you got to have the guts, and you got to be willing to get kicked in the, you know, whatties in order to move forward every day. So it's just important that you have all the fundamentals down and then enter into that game. So I'm not sure if that's exactly what you were looking for on the last call, Carmen, but that's what came to light as I'm going through this. So yeah.
You spoke right off the cuff and honest and transparent. Thank you. And I've known you for a lot of years. I'm happy for this big move you're making. Dwayne Myers is hanging with us. Incredible, phenomenal team out there at Dynamic Multi-Shop Owner. There's nothing we could teach Dwayne, but he's still here. it's amazing. Brian, you have the last word.
Hi. Hey, good to see you there, Dwayne. It's been a while. I'd like to just kind of follow up or add a little bit more to what Joe had to say, is that there's a saying that he who mentors himself has a fool for a mentor, right? So the real key here is just to find people that have gone through this before and or are going through it, and really can gather their experience and take it and apply it to what you're doing, and ask questions and really find out what's important to you. Think it through all the way and use other people's successes and other people's failures that have gone through the same process in order to make sure that you stack the deck in your favor so that you have the highest possibility of success. And Joe's right. We're in a growth and acquisition group, and having 15 other shop owners in a group that, and they're focused on growing their business and buying other businesses and handing off advice and experience and sharing and you know, talking. It's just been phenomenal. And I learn as much from, people like Joe that are just maybe acquiring their first, second location, if that makes sense, to people that that have 9-10 locations and have done it several times. I think there's just on every level there's something to share to other people and some to learn from other people. So if this is something you're looking to do, whether you're looking to sell, there's a lot of people that have gone through the selling process, and I would search out somebody that has been through that process, whether it's in the automotive industry or not.
Hey guys, thank you so much. This was eye-opening. I'm glad there were a lot of great learning points in this for the entire industry on both sides, buyers and sellers. Thank you so much. Hunt Demarest, CPA, Parr Mellis, accounting firm. It's kind of like, what do they say about that Hollywood stuff? For the stars. Accounting firm focused all on shops. Joe Hansen, Gordy's Garage, Roseville, Michigan, soon to be a multi-shop owner, and shared with his great experiences on what he's actually done to get here so far. And Brian Bates, if you will, our legacy guy, Eagle Automotive, Columbine Hills, Colorado, five shop owner, and the Napa National, the top national auto care shop of 2018. Have a great weekend. Thank you so much for your support. Bye, guys.
Thanks, Carm.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive aftermarket podcast. Until next time.